Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter from the Farm Machinery Digest. As always, I am your host, Ray Bohax, coming to you from our chilly family farm on Cat Swamp Road in Hackettstown, New Jersey. So, hey, hopefully everything is going well for you today. And we did get the winter did finally arrive last week, or the other day, I should say. And it got kind of chilly last week, but nothing too bad. And this, the other morning was -1 F for our listeners that are up in Canada or overseas. And so it was a little bit chilly, -1, but we had some snow, and we didn't get as much snow as they had predicted, which I have no problem with. We probably got about 4 inches. My sister lives up in Buffalo area, Tonawanda, New York. If anybody is a Chevy engine guy, there's a Chevy plant there. They used to make the big blocks there years ago. And they used to say on the valve covers, Tonawanda Forging. And she lives up there, and they got about 18 inches. We got about 4 inches, but then it was crazy. We had everything in one day. It was supposed to turn to sleet, but it didn't. It went right to rain. And we got about 1 inch of rain on 4 inches of snow, so you all know what that's about. And then the temperature dropped precipitously and went from 30 degrees down to -1 in about 6 or 7 hours. And the wind whipped up and everything froze like concrete. But thankfully, we were able to get to where I was cleaning it up with the tractor. And my wife, Charlotte, helped me in the chicken coop for my girls, the Trumpettes. And to clean that up for them so they're all good and dry and put shavings down. So everything is pretty good, thank God. Can't complain, it's winter time, but I could have done without the -1 freezing the snow hard as a rock. But what we're going to talk about today, you know, it's funny because, I guess it's not funny, it's a way of saying something, is that I give thought to what I would like to talk about on my show each week. Obviously, I don't just sit down and whip it out. But I do, everything is just right off the cuff. There's no script or anything. And I try to think about what I'm going to do on each show. And then the last couple of weeks, I've been saying to you that I wanted to start not a series, but the next month or so, or 4 or 5 or 6 shows, to talk about different things you could do in the farm shop to your equipment to get it ready for spring. And not the common things. For instance, like last week's podcast, we spoke about checking grounds and doing fluid analysis and other things. But and I felt that that would be very timely. And I am going to continue that. But what I am going to do today is I'm going to break away a little bit, because I figured winter is long enough that we have plenty of time to check things over in the farm shop. But I want to break away a little bit, and the catalyst for that was the cold weather. So what I am going to talk about today on the show is getting an engine to start when it's real cold. And I personally don't think -1 is real cold, but I know that there's listeners out west and up in western Canada that the temperature is, you know, -20, -30, -40 F. And at one particular point, I think it's at 32 or 33 degrees of minus on C, that it converts over more or less the same as Fahrenheit. But I should remember my math better, but I don't. When you live in the States and you deal with English all the time, even though you learned all of that in school, you have to get out the conversion chart to see what the equation is. But anyway, so today's show, I'm going to talk about getting an engine to start reliably in cold weather. And I think that's appropriate. You know, my wife gets a lot of women's magazines, and they always have trends in them. And they'll say, hey, you know, you get ready for summer swimsuit season, and that usually comes right after Christmas. And then they'll have, they'll have different trends for the seasons or whatever come up. So I guess it's not too bad of an idea to do that with a show with the podcast. But I also want to just break away and not get too much off on a tangent, which I am famous for. And so I want to try to stay on course for the new year and not get too much off into the weeds. But, you know, I go every morning to a truck stop, which is about 20 miles away. It's a TA truck stop and for coffee, and I go for a walk. And early in the morning, and I get coffee there, and I go for a walk, and it gives me the opportunity to get my mind ready for the day. You know, when you work at home, when you work on the farm, at least when working on the farm, I'm outside. But when I do my other business, as far as my writing and the Farm Machinery Digest and contributing to magazines, I'm in my office in the basement, which is where I am right now. So I can't simply just go from my bedroom upstairs to downstairs and start to create. So for many years now, I take a ride there in the morning. It's about 20 miles away one way. And I get my coffee, I draw it up, I meet people, and I go for a walk. I walk the whole back lot, and I am able to collect my thoughts, spend time with God. I see interesting stuff. It's an interesting dynamic because the truck's always constantly moving in and out, and you can see some beautiful things. You meet some interesting people and what have you. So that's what I do. And then this morning when I was getting my coffee at about, I get there about 5, between 5 and 5:30, usually about 5:15, depending upon the weather and what they have going on in the a.m. So I ran into this woman, and I was, she was looking for lids for the coffee cups and what have you. So, I'm not saying this that I'm going to stop here. I'm not saying this because I'm tooting my own horn, by no means. But there's a method to my madness for me telling you this. And, you know, it's interesting how just a hello or a smiling face or asking someone, just offering to help someone for finding for lids or coffee cups can make someone's day. And I know people have done that to me, and it makes my day. But to make a long story short, this woman was heading into Sloan Kettering in New York City, which is, most of you probably know that that's a big cancer center. And then she revealed to me that she had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that she that they thought was under control but was not. And they're going, and she's going into Sloan Kettering, and they're going to do some kind of new procedure where they take the T cells out of her blood. I'd never heard of it. And they actually attach I don't want to say a germ to it or what have you, but it's almost like BT corn. And they take this, they take her blood out, they attach a cell, onto the blood and re-put it back in here. And it's almost, and it's just like a BT corn. So it's amazing how, you know, there's two points I want to drive home here. It's amazing how the technology that we use in agriculture is migrating into the medical research field and going back and forth. And so many people are against GMO crops and BT biotech, or not biotech, you know, BT corn and all of this, and they really don't, and they're using it to cure cancer. So I think that's something, an important message that we need to understand and talk about. And the other thing I want to say is that if you happen to go to my website and go under the video tab, I have some videos. I'm not responsible with making any of them, but I have some videos that are really thought-provoking. Anything that's there is not junk. So it's of high quality and thought-provoking. And there is a video there called Empathy, and that is from the Cleveland Clinic. And it really is excellent. And it really, this morning, I really thought of that because this woman obviously wanted someone to talk to. And then just by showing her and showing her where the lids are, it gave her the opportunity to open up her life story. Not her life story, but her condition to me. And then I told her that I would pray for her. I asked for her name. And I'm very bad with remembering names until I really see the person a number of times. So I explained to her about how it was genetically modified crops, and they basically do the same thing, which she was very, very interested in. And I told her I'm going to pray for her and call her GMO girl. So if you get a chance, go to the website, and there's two videos that are favorites of mine, and one is empathy, and one is into the heart. And you really need to watch them, and you need to watch them multiple times, and it's really it really grounds you. So I just hope that you get a chance to do that. So empathy and into the heart, and into the heart is not about the car. Pay attention to the watch. Alrighty, now that I've wasted a lot of time telling you about that, but I don't think it is a waste of time, because if we could make someone's day, that's what life is all about. Alrighty, so now we're going to deal with cold start issues. What I'm going to do is that, you know, the hallmark of a good mechanic, the hallmark of a good hot rod farmer, or a good anybody who's with machinery, is that there's no excuses attached to anything. And, you know, think of it as like aviation or the space shuttle. There's no excuses. So there's no excuse or why an engine should not start up to a certain point in temperature. Now, keep in mind that gasoline, and without any great degree of ethanol in it, so like from E0 to, we'll say, like E10 or E15, and only because the majority of the fuel is gasoline, so the dynamics, the DNA of it, or its characteristics of how it works and how it functions and its chemical conversion is the same as almost as E0. Whereas once you get up to E85, there's some little bit different dynamics, because obviously it's 85% ethanol. And, you know, I'm a big supporter of ethanol, so, but for this conversation, I need to identify E0 to, we'll say, E15. But what needs to be understood is that at approximately minus 45 degrees F, that gasoline will not vaporize without an external heat source. So at minus 45 F, and that means that the fuel has to be 45F, and the carburetor or fuel injector has to be 45F. Because you could be saying to me, well, I've started in a gasoline engine, that the thermometer said it was minus 52. Yeah, but was the gasoline minus 52? The gasoline may have been minus 43, and that's why it vaporized. But what needs to be understood is that the rate of vaporization is very, very poor. At 60 degrees F, 60F, so it's a nice spring day, that the vaporization of gasoline is only about 50%. So about 50% of what is being put into that engine is only turning to a vapor. And keep in mind that three things need to happen to gasoline for it to become a fuel that is suitable to run an engine. It needs to be atomized, which means broken into small particles, fine particles, but still in a liquid form. Think of an aerosol can, all right, spraying from an aerosol can. All right, then it's broken into small particles, but it is still liquid. The next thing, it needs to be emulsified, which means mixed with air. And the third thing that needs to happen is it needs to go have a phase change from a liquid, albeit very small particles, to a gaseous state, meaning that it's rarefied, that it's no longer in liquid form. And to have the phase change occur, you need heat. And it actually, it's called the latent heat of vaporization. But gasoline will not vaporize at minus 45, minus 46 F or below. And up until that particular point, the rate of vaporization becomes so poor that you need to overfuel the engine to get it to start and then run. Now, once combustion starts, even on one cylinder, you're going to have the heat obviously increase from the combustion event, and it is going to improve the rate of vaporization. All right, so that is something that we need to understand. So there's what I'm going to discuss in this show today for you folks is that I'm going to discuss cold start, what you need to get a gasoline engine to cold start, and then what I'm going to do is about a diesel engine to cold start. But there are commonalities that we need to be concerned with between the two of them. All right, so what I'll do is that I'll talk about the commonalities, and if there is something that breaks away that's slightly different, I will address that for diesel, and then we will can pick that up as the show goes on. Alrighty, the first thing we need to be concerned with. We don't have gelling problems or anything with gasoline as you do with diesel fuel. So we don't have to, we take that right off the map. But there are the things we have to be concerned with are the cranking speed. All right, the cranking speed on any engine is going to be affected or impacted positively or negatively by the strength of the battery, and that is its current state of charge, along with its ability to put amps out, amperage, which is electron flow. So it's going to be the battery, the health of the battery, we'll use that term, the health of the starter motor, and which actually is called a cranking motor. Lay people call it a starter, and I call it a starter, but it's actually called a cranking motor because it does not start the engine, it turns the crankshaft, all right? The next thing is the condition of the cables, both the positive and the negative, and the cleanliness of the connections at the battery and at the ground and also at the starter. The next thing is the actual ground circuit. If the ground has a high, if there's a high voltage drop across the ground, we've discussed that on this show before, and you will lose a lot of power that way, so it needs to have a very efficient ground. And then the other thing is the thickness of the oil in the crankcase. So let's touch on these briefly. As far as the battery is concerned, the most accurate way for you to determine whether a battery has a capacity to crank an engine in the cold weather. Now, keep in mind that batteries do not like cold and they do not like hot. They want to live in Florida in the summertime, I mean, in wintertime when it's 70 degrees. So the colder it gets, the less chemical reaction happens in that battery, and as that battery ages and those cells become sulfated and become deteriorated, it gets affected more by the cold. Just like an older person or an older animal, their circulation is different, their body has aged, and they cannot take the cold as well as a younger person or younger animal. And you could see that with your cell phone even, is that if you leave your cell phone out and it's very, very cold, and you leave it in your car or your truck overnight or someplace, or leave it in the cab or the tractor, then it gets down to be minus something, 1, 2, 3, whatever the number be, 10 degrees F positive, is that you'll see that the amount of capacity that the battery has is greatly diminished. And then if you were without charging it, if you were to take that battery and then warm it up, even if you popped it out of your cell phone and put it in between your hands and held it so you have your body heat warming it up, you'll pop it back into the phone and see that the amount of charge is much greater. So all batteries have less storage power when it is cold than when it is warm. And then conversely, in extreme heat, the battery starts to ramp off also, but it gets affected more by the cold than the extreme heat. So if the battery is older, it is not going to have the ability to have the potential energy to crank the engine over when it is very cold. And the most accurate way for you to determine that, other than waiting for a minus 20 degree F day to test your battery, is on something called a load tester. It's a carbon pile. It puts a load across the battery. It's a tool that most mechanic shops have. You could buy an inexpensive handheld load tester that doesn't have that. That's probably puts 150 amps or so on it, and they're good. They're not as accurate as the professional ones, but they're also not $4,000. So a good rule of thumb that I like to tell people is that you could do a formal load tester, and this is, you know, obviously not when the vehicle or the engine doesn't want to start, you need to go feed cows. So this is a precursor to it. What you would do is put a voltmeter across the battery, and you would load it with something that leaves the headlights on for a few minutes on high beams, and then with the voltmeter across it, crank the engine, and you could disable it. However, that diesel or gasoline engine, however you want to say, but and crank it, and it should be able to crank for about 15 seconds, and the battery voltage should stay above 9.2, 9.6 volts. So anyway, so the thing is that the battery is going to be the key, because that is where the energy comes to turn the starter motor. Now, keep in mind that we have a weakened battery, and then we start to crank the engine, and we pull that voltage down. On a gasoline motor, that means we're also pulling that voltage down to the ignition system. And this, you know, what's going to happen is electricity is going to be passive, and it's going to whatever is the biggest load is going to steal from it. So if you're taking a lot of amperage from the starter and really pulling that battery down, then what you're going to do is you're going to have less voltage going into the ignition coil on a gasoline engine, which makes for a weaker spark. So that's why everything starts at the battery and its connections, because you need to be able to have the full output of that battery and to be able to crank that engine and be able to give the full voltage to the ignition system. Because if you don't have the full voltage to the ignition coil, you're going to have weak spark at the spark plug, and it is not going to ignite the fuel. Because remember, the rate of vaporization and thus the rate of ignition in cold weather is very poor. Now, the starter is very important, because if that starter is old or the engine had an oil leak in it, it's got a lot of oil leaked in, it's got a lot of crud in it or whatever, or the brushes are old, or the commutator is all worn, it's going to require more amperage from the battery to start it, and all of that is going to be exaggerated on a cold day, because there's going to be the contraction of all the parts. So now, basically, we have a battery that's weak, and we have a starter that is drawing too much energy. Now, I'm going to break away for 1 second there again. Is that it's imperative on both a gasoline and diesel engine, for two different reasons, that the engine cranks at a sufficient speed for it to start. On a gasoline engine, you need to crank it, have the crankshaft turn at a sufficient speed while it's starting, for two reasons. Number one is that if it's a carburetor, you need to be able to cause enough of a pressure differential, what we would call a depression, to pull fuel through the carburetor to basically get it into the engine. And even if it's a fuel-injected engine, the fuel, even though it's administered by an injector, that pressure differential is what actually pushes the fuel into the cylinder. So if the engine is cranking very slowly, you can't cause enough of a depression, gas, fuel-injected or carbureted, to pull enough fuel into that engine to get it to have to be able to ignite. So cranking speed is imperative. The engine needs to crank very fast, and that's why also a lot of snow blowers, they have a electric starter on them, and they also have a pull start, and they have that because you could turn it over much quicker with the electric start, so you have more depression and you could pull the fuel into the cylinder, whereas the rope start, you can't physically pull the crankshaft speed during starting is not as high. So keep that in mind, is that if you have a starter that is oily, greasy, and what have you, that it's going to draw more current and it's going to make the engine harder, more ornery to start, even with a brand new battery in it. And the same thing comes with the cables. And with the cables, if the cables are old and the corroded, I've said this before in the show when I spoke about voltage drop, that a lot of battery cables that go from the battery to either the ground or to the starter or solenoid, whatever that particular application has, is that they'll get corrosion up between the cable and the insulation, and it'll have a high amount of resistance in there, and you will not be able to get the full battery potential energy to that cranking motor or starter motor. So the cables are important, the ground circuit is important, and the thickness of the oil. So all of these things are going to impact the cranking speed on a gasoline or diesel engine. So it's going to be the condition of the battery, the condition of the starter, the condition of the cables, the condition of the ground circuit, even brand new cables. If you can put brand new cables and you have a dirty ground or the bolt that holds it and that's all corroded there and you don't clean it before you put it on, is that you're going to have a high impedance ground, and thus you're going to have lower voltage going into the starter circuit, lower cranking speed, and lower ignition input voltage. And then the last thing is the thickness of the oil. That was one of the things years ago. Everybody used to run 1040 oil, 20 W50 oil. And keep in mind that the W stands for winter, not weight. And if the oil is too thick, it's going to create a parasitic loss in the crankcase, because it's going to be very hard for the crankshaft to turn through that oil, but also for it to pump that oil up into the critical parts of the engine. And that is one of the reasons why all of the new engines use much thinner weight oils. The chemistry of the oil has changed dramatically, and we're able to support what is called the oil wedge theory, which I will do a show on that probably sometime later on this year. I'll put it in my list. And the oil wedge, so it could maintain the oil wedge, which, to give you a heads up for that, that's the thickness of the oil, the cushion between the bearing and the journal, that actually holds the journal of the crankshaft or the connecting rod off the main bearings. So that is what's called the oil wedge. It is not the thickness. People confuse that with the thickness of the bearing clearance. No, it's called the oil wedge, and the oil needs to maintain that wedge, that separation between, so it's not metal to metal. But that is one of the reasons why all of the new engines have a thinner oil, because they want to get up to all the parts quicker, move quicker through the engine, and they want to have less parasitic loss from the cranking or cold start especially, but also on hot restart. But obviously cold start, when the oil is the thickest, it's the most problematic. So if you're a guy who's running 20/50 oil in something, or 10/50 or 15/50, then if everything is good, the battery is good, the starter is good, the cables are good, everything is good, that you will have a sufficient cranking speed to start that engine. But if not, then all bets are off, because if you don't get that crankshaft turning fast enough, you're not going to be able to bring that charge into that cylinder, even on a diesel. Because even though if you have a nozzle, and if it's a indirect injection diesel, where it sprays into a pre-chamber, or even a direct injection diesel, you need to be able to have that cranking speed there. And we're going to touch on that, because diesel has some interesting aspects to it. Alrighty, so let's move quickly into gasoline. We spoke about poor rate of vaporization of fuel, and keep in mind that the dynamics of fuel vaporization have not changed, whether it's a carbureted motor or an injected motor. What has changed is the theory, the method of way the enrichment is provided, and also how that fuel is both atomized and vaporized. But when you go to the gas pump in town and you buy whatever 5 gallons of gas to put in your lawnmower, or you put 5 gallons of gas in your pickup truck, there's not a gas pump that says lawnmower, it says pickup truck, SUV, whatever. It's all the same. So the dynamics of the fuel do not change with the application that it is poured into. So now on a carburetor, we have a choke, and we usually have a pull off, and that's with an automatic choke. And the thing is that if you have a smaller engine, it would have a hand choke, not an automatic choke. But what a lot of people don't understand is the purpose of the choke. They realize that the purpose of the choke is to give the engine enrichment because of the poor vaporization rate of the fuel, but they think that it's actually choking off air. And what it's really not doing is, it's the choke plate, in simplistic terms, we could do a whole show on this. The choke plate actually blocks off the entrance to the carburetor to expose, and the word is expose, full cranking vacuum, full manifold vacuum to the main metering circuit to pull the maximum amount of fuel from the boost through the booster. So, and through the idle circuit. So what's basically happening is that we're limiting the airflow. So think of it this way. If you take a straw and you suck on a straw and you have the straws completely open, you suck. It's very easy. Now you close that off, right? And you have and you close off and you try to suck, and then the amount of effort you take is much higher to try to suck through it. And in essence, and I'm going to put a article up on the learning series probably next week or two about truly how a choke works, and it's important for you to understand that, because even though you have fuel injected engines, if you have a seed tender, you have a lawnmower, you have something else, you have a pump that you pump fertilizer from a tote, and it's gasoline powered, it's going to have a choke, a small engine. So some bigger small engines have EFI, but they're basically going to have a choke, so it's important if you understand that. So in essence, it's exposing full manifold vacuum to the Venturi so the carburetor could pull the maximum amount of fuel because of the poor rate of vaporization, and also because of the slower cranking speed because of the thickness of the oil and the contraction of the parts in the engine and the weakness of the battery. So it's actually not limiting the air, it's actually controlling the vacuum that the Venturi of the carburetor sees. And so if that choke is not working properly, and if it's an automatic choke, a lot of people don't know how to start an engine with an automatic choke. So let's say you have an older irrigation motor. Well, you wouldn't be irrigating in the winter, but the thing, you have an old engine on a genset, whatever, plow truck, whatever it may be, an old gasoline engine, and it has an automatic choke. The proper way to start that engine is to go and slowly put your foot to the floor twice, to the floor once, release, slowly twice, again, all right, and release. And what that'll do is that if the automatic choke spring is working properly and the choke is not stuck, it will move the throttle, the fast idle screw, away from the cam, a fast idle cam, and allow the choke butterfly fly to close, and will also actually provide a shot each time you move the throttle, the full deflection of the accelerator pump to spray some fuel into the intake manifold. So what you do is once to the floor, release, twice to the floor, release. Now you go and crank. If it doesn't start in 10 seconds of cranking, 10 seconds. 10 seconds doesn't sound like a long time, but it's a long time when you're cranking an engine. So if it doesn't start within, I like to say, 4 or 5 crankshaft revolutions, not seconds. But some people in the industry say seconds. Then you stop cranking, and you could give it another halfway shot to the floor, and then back, so you give it a little bit more accelerator pump stroke, and then she should light off. If that choke needs to be set properly as far as spring tension is concerned, and it also needs to be free to move. And once that engine fires, in most instances, they'll have what's called a choke pull-off or a choke break. And this choke pull-off will actually open up the choke plate slightly to reduce the amount of vacuum that the main metering circuit is going to pull fuel through the booster during crank, and then it'll start, so it'll lean it out slightly, and then as the temperature comes up, the choke, an automatic choke, will actually start to open because of the bimetallic spring. If it's a hand choke, then you would modulate it by hand, but the function is the same, all right, as far as creating a very, exposing the circuit of the carburetor to a high vacuum signal, a great amount of depression, so it actually pushes the fuel into the engine. And as I may not have said, I wanted to a minute or so ago, is that the pressure differential is what puts fuel into an engine. So the low pressure or vacuum, which is any pressure of the low atmospheric, and the atmospheric pressure pushes the fuel through the carburetor, and even on an injected engine, it pushes the charge into the cylinder. So it's the pumping action of the piston. Some people say it sucks fuel or pulls fuel. Well, it really doesn't. It's a push-pull relationship. So now what people do, and I really saw this from the car side of my life, is they don't know how to start an engine with automatic choke. They're wrapping the throttle while they're cranking. They're putting it to the floor. You don't want to do that, because every time that you put your foot to the floor while you're cranking, most, when I say modern, the past 50 years, 40 years, carburetors will have what they call a choke unloader. And when you put your foot to the floor, it opens up the choke plate, so you're not getting that enrichment. Alrighty? So that's something. Twice to the floor, release crank. If it doesn't start, stop cranking. Another half a shot to the floor, give it a little bit more accelerator, pump stroke, crank, and then she should go off. Now, if the engine wants to load up right after it starts, then that means that the choke pull-off angle is not working or it's misadjusted. So it's not giving enough air right after it starts. And the hallmark of that would be the engine would start fine and starts to run for a few seconds and then starts to go boom, 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 and starts to blow black smoke out of the back and everything. That's a choke pull-off angle. And historically, on an older engine, the diaphragm in a choke pull-off will have rotted or dry rotted or actually expanded from oil film, oil fumes, not film, and would not be pulling the choke open. Alrighty? So, in essence, if you have a gasoline engine and you could get it to crank well and provide, because of, due to all the things that we discussed, you get it to crank well and at a good cranking speed and supply sufficient voltage to the ignition coil, the choke, be it automatic choke or manual choke, is set properly. If it's a manual choke, even on a small engine, like a snowblower or something, a lot of them have a prime button. That's giving it a shot of fuel into the intake manifold. Right? And that's all set properly, and that engine will start. There's no reason why it's not starting. Ready? So if you're getting good voltage to the ignition coil, it's sparking the spark plugs, good cranking speed, enough enrichment for to deal with the poor rate of vaporation, she's going off, right? Now, what happens afterwards is a different story, because what you need to do, what a lot of people will do, and is that they'll go out and they'll short duty cycle. They'll start an engine, and let's say, oh, I want to see if it's going to start today, because I got to go into town, and it's real cold out. Keep in mind that on any gasoline engine, I don't care what year it is, fuel injected, carbureted, that you need to get that spark plug center electrode to over 500 degrees F for it to start to burn off the cranking fuel, which is most engines, gasoline engines, will crank at a 1 to 1 or 2 to 1 air fuel ratio. And running, there'll be a 14 to 1 or 15 to 1 air fuel ratio, 14.7. So what that means is that on a 2 to 1 air fuel ratio, there's two parts of air for every part of fuel. On a 15 to 1, there's 15 parts of air for every part of fuel. So a carbureted engine needs to be extremely rich during crank because of the loss of the fuel dropping off through the wet flow intake manifold before it gets to the cylinder, and then also during warm-up, or what we would call transition from dead cold to full operating temperature. So there's a lot of fuel drop-off because of that poor rate of vaporization. But the spark plug needs to get to be, the center electrode needs to see at least to be, and I don't mean 1 second at 500 degrees. It needs to stabilize at a minimum of 500 degrees for it to burn off that cranking fuel and that cold start enrichment. If you wet the plugs on a gasoline engine, buddy, it's all over. All right? So slow cranking speed and that a weak battery pulling voltage from that coil, all right? So you have a weak spark. If that thing don't go right off, then you're wetting those plugs. And once you wet those plugs, that engine is not starting, and those plugs will not dry out with it in the cylinder. You need to pull those plugs out, and I take them into the shop, and I like to wire wheel them and blow them off and clean them and put them back in if that happens. But that is, that's very, very common. The guy has a weak battery, or he has, if the engine doesn't crank, you're better off than it cranking and not being able to light off, because if it doesn't crank, you're not wetting the plugs. So keep that in mind, is that you need to be able to run that engine when you cold start it, run it at least for a couple of minutes without, even if you say, oh, I'm just going to start it and then I'm going to move the snowblower. I'm using that as an example. Let it run, because you have to stabilize that spark plug temperature. Otherwise, you'll wet that plug and game over. You're pulling the plugs out and cleaning it, because they will not dry off inside the cylinder when they're that wet. All right, eventually it'll dry off by summertime, but they're not going to dry off the time that you need to get that engine. So if we have all of that together, this thing is running, okay? And then if it runs poorly with a carburetor during the transition period, it is usually the choke pull-off circuit where it's not opening up the choke plate enough. Now, let's continue on with gasoline, and let's talk about EFI. With EFI, what will happen is that everything is the same, but you need to make sure the way the enrichment comes up is through what is called a coolant sensor. It's usually a combination of a coolant and an air charge temperature sensor, and that gives the enrichment. But what you need to do, and you should do this every time you start an engine, is to be able to turn the key on. You'll hear the electric fuel pump prime. That means it primes the fuel rail. And then once you prime the fuel rail, then you go into crank. You don't go right to crank on any EFI engine, even on an 80-degree day. You need to prime that fuel rail. And then that means that you're cranking the engine, and it'll get fuel immediately. And if you have a very, very cold weather or a marginal battery, that letting that fuel pump prime first could be the difference between that thing starting and not starting. But other than the prime circuit, there's nothing that you need to be concerned with any differently than you are with a carbureted engine. All of the dynamics of vaporization, cranking speed, cables, starter integrity, thickness of oil all come into play. Now, let's jump over to diesel. Diesel is a little bit different because what happens is that it is compression ignition. So you need to be able to have, this is rule of thumb, so don't hold me to the exact number, but diesel fuel needs, for it to auto-ignite, self-ignite, compression ignition, it needs to see a temperature of around 230 degrees C centigrade, which works out to about 446 degrees F. So below that temperature, say 450 degrees, is that you're not going to light that diesel fuel off. And that's why an oil burner has an arc, electrodes that arc, right? Because it doesn't have any, it burns diesel fuel, but doesn't have any compression. It's really not an internal combustion engine. It could be almost considered, you know, quasi open chamber engine, or engine that open chamber combustion, like fuel in a barrel. So, you need to get that air up to about 450 degrees for that diesel fuel to ignite. So how does it do this? It does this by having a very high compression ratio. So you're taking the air molecules and you're squeezing them into a tight area. So it needs to do that by having good cylinder seal. And it needs to have a sufficient cranking speed, not only to create that differential of pressure from atmosphere into the engine to put charge in, but it needs to have enough cranking speed for it to heat that air up, because it needs to eventually get to 450 degrees F for it to ignite. So, the older engines that did not have glow plugs years ago, right, and people used to plug them in and do all of this stuff, and what you had to do was to get them to crank their stuff, they used to start on ether. And the reason why they would start on ether is that ether has a much lower ignition point temperature than diesel fuel, all right? So, the diesel fuel needs to see around 450 degrees. So, on a more modern diesel, they do it two ways. So, let's say arguably that mathematically you could figure this out, assuming that there's very good cylinder seal. But this is not an engineering show, it's an engineering podcast. So, you only need to understand it to this level. So, let's say that the compression of the air from the crankshaft turning sufficiently with enough velocity, enough RPM, and it compresses the air, and the ring seal is good, and it compresses the air, it gets it up to 300 degrees, okay? So it's 20 degrees outside, whatever number you want, and it gets it up to 300 degrees. That's not enough. We need 450, all right? How do we get it to 450? All right, so how we get it to 450 and start on diesel fuel is that we either use a glow plug, or some of the more modern engines use an intake air heater. So now, instead of having 20-degree air with an intake air heater that we are trying to compress and have enough increase of temperature from compression, is that we heat the air with an intake air heater, and that is 200 degrees. So now, if we bring it up to 250 degrees, I'm making up numbers as we go along, she lights off. All right? So that's the purpose of an intake air heater. That's why you don't need ether, because you're preheating the air before it goes into the thermodynamic cycle of compressing the molecules, squeezing them together, right? You get squeezed together, the act of compressing them, the friction of compressing them is going to raise heat, and then the fuel gets to 450 degrees. Or the air gets 450 degrees, and we have auto ignition, diesel compression, ignition. Alrighty? Now, with a glow plug, what's basically going to happen is a lot of people don't understand it. They say they see this little tip like a spark plug in the cylinder, and then that's going to get hot, and it's going to ignite the fuel. But the glow plug really is not there to heat the air in the combustion chamber, or I should say in the cylinder, not the combustion chamber. So the dynamics of that is that the piston is still squeezing the air molecules, and then it pushes the fuel and air mixture, the air-fuel ratio, that's heated to a certain extent from the compression action over by the glow plug, and then the glow plug acts like a spark plug, but instead of arcing and sparking, it's staying hot, and then like a soldering iron. And then what happens is when the piston comes up, and that's why the glow plug is on the top of the cylinder, as the piston comes up with the charges air and fuel mixed together. Let's say it's 250 degrees from the compression action. The fuel hits the glow plug. The glow plug is 600 degrees at the tip, and the fuel lights off, and the engine starts. And as an aside to this, more modern diesels that you'll find will actually, the older diesels, you manually turned on the glow plug with a switch, usually with the ignition switch in the crank position, and then once you went away from there and you went to start, you crank the engine, and let me back up, I'm getting too excited here. You would heat the glow plugs with the ignition switch, then turn it to crank, the engine would start, and you would release it. After, when the engine is running, and also during the crank, most of the applications, the glow plugs were not lighting, already extinguished, but they had residual heat. On a lot of modern diesels, what will happen, even if they'll have a combination of an intake air heater and glow plugs, and the glow plug will actually stay on after the engine starts, and that is so the engine runs very cleanly. You have these new pickup trucks, these Tier 4 engines, right? You go in there, you start them at 20 below zero, and the thing is that you go and you start it, and it runs nice and clean. It runs smoothly during its cold, warm, right after it goes from crank to run, is because it keeps the glow plugs on for a while based upon the air temperature and the coolant temperature. So that's so it runs cleanly and runs nicely when it during the transition from cranking to run. All right. So recap very quickly. Intake air heater heats the air. The lion's share of the heat is made through the compression of the air molecules during crank. So that's why cranking speed and everything comes into play. If you have glow plugs, cranking speed comes into play still, but also the amount of voltage going to that glow plug, because if you starve it for voltage, it's not going to get as hot. Alrighty. And then a lot of engines also have an enrichment circuit on an older pump line nozzle. They'll have some sort of enrichment circuit on the injection pump that may go, that usually looks at a coolant temperature sensor or air temperature sensor. And then in a modern common rail system, basically it's like a 90%, 95% of a gasoline fuel injection system. So it has intake air temperature, it has a whole bunch of other things going on. But now, this is all great, right? But the thing we need to do is get the fuel to the engine. And diesel fuel, as we all know, has a propensity to gel, all right, and to not want to flow when it is cold. So very, very simple, and I'm preaching to the choir here. What you need to do is additize your diesel, and I'm a big proponent of additizing your diesel fuel all year round for other reasons, for lubricity, to get moisture out of it, for cetane boost. But the best diesel fuel conditioners, if you say, I'm not listening to that hot rod farmer, I'm not advertising my fuel in the summertime. Well, if you're going to do it in the winter, right, if you do it in the winter, you need an additive that not only stops it from gelling and improves the cold the cold filter plugging point and the pour point so the fuel stays liquid, but you need to increase the cetane value of that fuel. So the best cold weather additives in not only keep the fuel in the fuel in liquid form, it also raises the cetane. Because the cetane, if you listen to my show a while back, one of the early shows, and I have an article on my website under the learning series about cetane and octane, cetane is the fuel's anxiousness to ignite. So higher cetane fuel will be more anxious to ignite in hot and in cold weather. So if you have higher cetane, then that fuel is going to ignite easier when it gets to that 400-degree, 450-degree mark, be it through compression and glow plugs or compression intake air heater. So people think of don't think of cetane as a cold start aid. They just think, and that's the same thing in the summertime. You have an 80-degree day because that fuel, that air starts to get to 450 degrees. That's a long way, buddy, from 80 degrees to 450 for it to ignite. So the higher the cetane in the fuel is going to make it easier, more anxious is the word I like to use to ignite. So you want an additive that not only stops, keeps the fuel in liquid form, the diesel fuel, that you want it to be a cetane improver. So if you have those two, so basically, let's recap before I get into the special delivery segment. Then the recap is we need to be able to gasoline or diesel have good cranking speed, so that's battery, starter, cables, ground, and oil thickness. Gasoline engine, we need to be able to have the enrichment circuit, whether it's a choke circuit on a carburetor or a enrichment circuit through a coolant sensor, an air charge sensor on an EFI system. On EFI, we need to do the prime pulse to charge the fuel rail before we go into crank. On a carburetor, if it's an automatic choke, we need to manually set that choke by operating the gas pedal slowly to the floor twice, then go into crank. If it doesn't start, we're not touching the gas pedal, all right? We'll stop cranking. We'll give it another shot from the accelerator pump, and then we'll crank again. Keep in mind on a gasoline engine to burn off that cranking fuel and that cranking fuel and that cold start enrichment, that spark plug center electrode has to become a minimum 500 degrees F for it to start to burn off that fuel. So you don't want to shut the engine right off after 30 seconds or a minute. You want to let it stabilize, right? Because what actually has to happen is not only that, there needs to be something called a reaction zone happening in the cylinder, which is a show on to itself. But that's what you need to know. And this stuff here, you don't need to be an engine guy to do this, all right? When it comes to diesel, we need to have glow plugs that work properly, and I am going to do a show on glow plugs probably within the next month or so. Glow plugs to work properly, cranking speed, we spoke about that, and we need to get it fuel. The fuel needs to stay in liquid form, and it needs to have increased cetane, increased ignitability. You do this, forget about it. This thing is going off, all right, and you will actually, if you could keep that fuel liquid and have a high enough cetane level, all right, you could actually have a diesel engine start in much colder weather than a gasoline engine because we're not dealing with that rate of vaporization at minus 45 that goes down to almost zero. All righty? So hopefully you got something from this. Any questions about it? You know, please feel free to contact me as always at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now we're going to go quickly into our special delivery segment. And special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag. They're a company that was founded by Harvey Firestone, who is a fourth generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Mr. Firestone dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar and AD2 technology. I love that 23-degree tread bar. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So we have a very short letter today. It is from Chuck in Manitoba. And hopefully he's listening because I know it's real, real cold up there this time of year, probably minus 42 or 43 F, not C. So, and he has an older spray coupe. I guess it's a Melrose spray coupe. I think Melrose made them spray coupe with a GM alternator. And he says that the alternator seems to be charging. The battery really doesn't go dead, but he notices when he comes to idle the engine that it has the charge light and the light is glimmering. And then it's glimmering most of the time, and even at higher RPM, the light is glimmering. Very, very simple. When you have a glimmering light on an charging circuit, glimmering charge light, very low glimmering, you could see it better if you shut the lights off in the dark, maybe a little bit during the day, and specifically on a Delcatron alternator, that is a defective diode trio in the alternator. It's about a $6 part. And you would take the alternator part, split the case, and I believe I have an article on that on my learning series on the website. You would split the case, and there's what you'll find is a rectifier bridge in there, and on top of it is a diode. You will know it's a diode unless somebody told you, like I'm telling you. It has three legs. It goes to one, goes to each terminal of the rectifier bridge, and then there's another leg off. So basically, it's one finger down and then three fingers. So if you will be holding your hand out and have your three middle fingers, and take your finger from your other hand, your index finger, and put it over there, that's what it looks like. So it's four legs, three together and one. That is the diode trio. When the diode trio starts to go, is failing, what a diode is a one-way electrical check valve. It only allows current to flow one way. It feeds current both ways. What you will find is that the output of the alternator will be lower. So instead of 14.6, 14.7, maybe 13.7, 13.8, 13.9. And then that light will glimmer because it's feeding it some unrectified AC. Take the alternator off, mark the case, split it apart, go to town, a better auto parts store, and get a take the number off the alternator. Usually it just goes by the amperage rating of the alternator, and then buy a diode trio. The last time I bought one, they were about $6 or $7, maybe I'm wrong, $10, and you very, very simple, three nuts and a screw, take it off, put it back on there, put the alternator together, and it'll be fine. And you will have to take the brushes will pop out, so I like to use a spray tip from a carburetor cleaner or a brake clean and put it in there to hold the brushes. But that's basically it. But diode trio is bad on that, and if you don't feel comfortable doing it, bring it to an alternator shop. But if everything else is fine in the alternator, that's all you need. Well, listen, thank you so much. I was talking fast, and I know that because I'm excited about this. I'm excited about you having your engine starting when the cold weather. And I'm excited and honored to be able to talk to you on your farm from my farm in New Jersey. Listen, just always know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. You have a blessed day, and hopefully you will listen next week. And next week we're going to be discussing volumetric efficiency. So you may want to tune in. Thank you. Bye-bye.